Elevated blood pressure during pregnancy is a significant problem, affecting as many as 10% of pregnancies. In some cases, the hypertension is pre-existing, while in others, it develops over the course of pregnancy. Occasionally, it does both. There are some normal blood pressure changes occurring during pregnancy. During the middle trimester, blood pressure, both systolic and diastolic, normally drops below early pregnancy and pre-pregnancy levels. Frequently, there's a widening of the pulse pressure, in other words, the difference between the systolic and diastolic levels. These changes are associated with the significant reduction in peripheral vascular resistance and some degree of AV shunting within the uterus and intravillous space. The decreased peripheral resistance is compensated by the relative tachycardia so often found among pregnant women. In the third trimester, blood pressure usually rises to approximately pre-pregnancy levels. Elevations significantly higher than that are considered abnormal. The definition of hypertension varies, but one common definition is the sustained elevation of blood pressure above 140 over 90. Most obstetricians believe that if either the systolic or the diastolic pressure is elevated on a sustained basis, that hypertension exists. A few require that both be elevated. But as a practical matter, in most cases of hypertension, both are elevated. The diastolic pressure elevation is probably the more important of the two, and mean arterial pressure during the second or third trimester are used by some to assess risk. As you remember, the mean arterial pressure is one-third the distance from the diastolic pressure to the systolic pressure. This can be expressed mathematically by adding two diastolic pressures to the systolic pressure and dividing the total by 3. During the second trimester, if the average of all mean arterial pressures are greater than 90, there is a significantly increased risk for perinatal mortality, morbidity, and impaired fetal growth dynamics. During the third trimester, mean arterial pressures greater than or equal to 105 indicates an increased risk. Women with pre-existing hypertension face increased risk during their pregnancy for diminished uterine blood flow, preeclampsia, and if uncontrolled, maternal stroke. For these reasons, it's important for those with pre-existing hypertension that they be appropriately treated and followed during pregnancy. Toxemia of pregnancy is an older term for preeclampsia and eclampsia. The only difference between preeclampsia and eclampsia is the presence of maternal seizures in eclampsia. This is a clinical syndrome characterized by elevated blood pressure, protein in the urine, fluid retention, and increased reflexes. It occurs only during pregnancy and resolves completely after pregnancy. It is seen most often as women approach full term, but can occur as early as the 22nd week of pregnancy. Its cause is unknown, but occurs more often in women carrying their first child, multiple pregnancies, pregnancies with excessive amniotic fluid, also known as polyhydramnios. It occurs more often in younger women, less than age 17, and in older women, greater than age 35. It occurs more often in women with pregestational diabetes, obese women, women with pre-existing hypertension, renal disease, and phospholipid syndrome. It occurs more often among women with a personal or family history of preeclampsia. Remember that blood pressure normally decreases during the middle trimester, then rises back toward the pre-pregnancy levels. Sometimes, blood pressure becomes elevated. Sustained blood pressures exceeding 140 over 90 are considered abnormal. If, after a careful search for other factors, the only abnormality that has developed during pregnancy is mild hypertension, then this is called gestational hypertension and is considered less threatening than preeclampsia. Importantly, those patients with gestational hypertension must have blood pressures less than 160 over 110, they must have no significant proteinuria, and no other preeclampsia symptoms, signs, or laboratory findings. Of course, these patients need to be closely watched because some of them will go on to develop the other findings that we associate with the more dangerous preeclampsia. For women with pre-pregnancy hypertension, a sustained worsening of their hypertension over pre-pregnancy levels by 30 systolic and 15 diastolic is often used to indicate the possible presence of superimposed preeclampsia. Let's consider the diagnosis. Hypertension and protein in the urine are the two essential findings used to confirm the diagnosis of toxemia of pregnancy. Normal pregnant women can lose up to 200 milligrams of protein in the urine in 24 hours. If protein loss exceeds 300 milligrams in 24 hours, this is considered proteinuria. Urine dipstick analysis for protein measures only a single point in time and does not necessarily reflect protein loss over 24 hours. Nonetheless, assuming average urine production of about a liter a day and consistent loss throughout the 24-hour period, A 1-plus finding on a spot urine is equivalent to 300 milligrams or more in 24 hours. Edema is part of the classical description of preeclampsia, along with hypertension, proteinuria, and increased maternal reflexes. Some, but not all, women with preeclampsia demonstrate fluid retention, as evidenced by edema or sudden weight gain exceeding 2 pounds per week. Some amount of dependent edema is so common among pregnant women that its presence by itself is not particularly alarming. Likewise, the absence of edema in a pregnant woman with a persistently elevated blood pressure and significant proteinuria should not dissuade you from making the diagnosis of preeclampsia. The diagnosis hinges on the presence of persistent hypertension and significant proteinuria. Some, but not all, women with toxemia will demonstrate increased reflexes. However, everyone is different, and stress can also increase reflexes. So I don't generally rely on the presence or absence of increased reflexes to help me make the diagnosis of preeclampsia. I believe the most useful application of reflex testing is in a woman who has already been diagnosed with preeclampsia. In this patient, the severity of her reflex responses, 3 to 4 plus, for example, or even clonus, will help me gauge how close she may be to having an eclamptic seizure. The more brisk the reflexes, the more danger of seizure. Most women with preeclampsia have no symptoms. Many feel quite good and are confused about why everyone around them acts so alarmed. Among those with symptoms are such findings as headache, usually frontal but sometimes occipital, and it's analgesic resistant, visual disturbances, including blurring and scotomata, and aching pain in the right upper quadrant caused by stretching of the liver capsule. The causes of preeclampsia are not known. Some common associations are first pregnancies, pre-existing hypertension, high detitiform mole, and those conditions that lead to overdistension of the uterus, such as polyhydramnios and multiple gestation. Physiologically, women with this condition demonstrate peripheral vascular spasm, leading to injury of the capillary walls and leakage of intravascular fluids into the extracellular spaces. Due to the somewhat impaired kidney function that accompanies this condition, serum creatinine levels are usually modestly increased, greater than 1 mg per cent. Hemoconcentration results in a modest increase in hemoglobin and hematocrit. Both contribute to an elevation of BUN, usually greater than 12 mg per cent. Uric acid is typically greater than 5.5 mg per cent due to increased production in association with peripheral vascular sluggishness. Let's consider the consequences. Preeclampsia, eclampsia, and the HELLP syndrome are very dangerous, with potentially serious consequences for both the mother and the fetus. Among these are preterm delivery, placental abruption, precipitous delivery, maternal convulsions, decreased uteroplacental perfusion, fetal growth restriction, increased perinatal mortality, maternal renal failure, maternal disseminated intravascular coagulation and hemorrhage, liver failure, pulmonary edema, and maternal stroke. Fortunately, most cases of toxemia of pregnancy are mild, and most of the more severe forms are successfully treated before the serious consequences can unfold. In some severe cases, even early diagnosis and treatment will prove unsuccessful in avoiding the more serious consequences. Toxemia of pregnancy is divided into two categories, preeclampsia and eclampsia. The difference is the presence of seizures in women with eclampsia. The clinical course of preeclampsia is variable. Some women demonstrate a mild, stable course of the disease with modest elevations of blood pressure and no other symptoms. This is called mild preeclampsia. Others display a much more aggressive disease with deterioration of both maternal and fetal condition. This is called severe preeclampsia. Notice that there is no moderate preeclampsia, only mild and severe. With mild preeclampsia, the patient has mildly elevated blood pressures, at least 140 over 90, but not as high as 160 over 110. She'll have a 1-plus protein in her urine spot checks, which represent 24-hour production of between 300 and 1,000 milligrams. She may or may not have edema and increased reflexes. With severe preeclampsia, she'll have at least one additional finding beyond the expected findings for mild preeclampsia. These additional findings include the symptoms of upper abdominal pain, severe headaches, and visual disturbances. Additional findings include laboratory tests showing decreased urine output, less than 500 milliliters in 24 hours, decreased platelets of less than 100,000 per milliliter, increased creatinine, increased uric acid, and increased liver enzymes of ALT and AST. The definitive treatment of preeclampsia is delivery. The urgency of delivery depends on the gestational age of the fetus, the status of the fetus, and the severity of the disease in the mother. Severe preeclampsia usually requires urgent delivery within hours, more or less regardless of gestational age. In this situation, the risk of serious complications such as placental abruption, growth restriction, liver failure, renal failure, hemorrhage, coagulopathy, seizures, and death will generally take precedence over the fetal benefit of prolonging the pregnancy. Induction of labor is preferred unless the maternal condition is so tenuous and the cervix so unfavorable that cesarean section is warranted. In milder cases, particularly if remote from term or with an unfavorable cervix, treatment may range from hospitalization with close observation to initial stabilization followed by induction of labor following preparation of the cervix over the course of several days. In the most mild selected cases, outpatient management might be considered with careful monitoring of maternal and fetal condition. Traditionally, magnesium sulfate has been used to treat preeclampsia. Magnesium sulfate in high enough doses is a reasonably effective anticonvulsant, it's a mild antihypertensive, and a mild diuretic. While other agents may be more potent in each of these individual areas, none combines all three of these features into a single drug. The world's experience with magnesium sulfate to treat preeclampsia is extensive, and these unique features provide considerable reassurance in employing it in these clinical settings. Magnesium sulfate is given intramuscularly, intravenously, or both. Both are reasonably effective in preventing seizures. Because the risk of eclampsia continues after delivery, magnesium sulfate is frequently continued for 24 to 48 hours after delivery. The therapeutic margin is the distance between effective dose and toxicity. It's relatively thin with magnesium sulfate, so some precautions need to be taken. If magnesium levels are subtherapeutic, the patient will still be vulnerable to seizures. If magnesium levels are too great, the most serious problem is respiratory depression occurring at around 10 milliequivalents per liter and respiratory arrest occurring at around 12 or more milliequivalents per liter. Cardiovascular collapse occurs at levels exceeding 25 milliequivalents per liter. Magnesium levels can be measured in a hospital setting with a target range of between 5 and 8 milliequivalents per liter. However, clinical management works about as well and is non-invasive. The patellar reflexes, the knee jerk, disappear as magnesium levels rise above 10 milliequivalents per liter. Periodic checking of these patellar reflexes and withholding of magnesium sulfate if reflexes are absent will usually keep your patient away from respiratory arrest. This is particularly important if renal function is impaired, as it often is in severe preeclampsia, since magnesium is cleared entirely by the kidneys. Likewise, respiratory depression occurs prior to respiratory arrest. So, breathing can be monitored and magnesium withheld if respirations are less than 12 breaths per minute. Finally, since magnesium is excreted in the urine, should renal failure occur, an unaltered dose of magnesium is likely to result in hypermagnesemia. As long as urine output exceeds 100 milliliters in 4 hours, no modification of the magnesium is necessary on the basis of impaired renal function. In the case of respiratory arrest or severe respiratory depression, the effects of magnesium can be quickly reversed by the administration of calcium. The favored dosage of calcium gluconate is 1 gram intravenously over 5 minutes. This should be given only in the event of life-threatening depression because milder forms of hypermagnesemia can be effectively controlled by just reducing the magnesium dose. Understand that when you abruptly reverse the effects of magnesium, you are also removing the protective halo against seizures. If blood pressure is persistently greater than 160 over 110, an antihypertensive agent is usually given to lower the blood pressure to levels closer to 140 over 90. There are a number of commonly used agents used for this purpose, including labetalol, nifedipine, and hydralazine. Regardless of the medication, try not to drop the pressure too far, below a diastolic of 90, as uterine perfusion may be compromised. Let's talk for a while about eclampsia. Eclampsia means that a previously preeclamptic patient experiences maternal seizures. These tonic-clonic episodes last for several minutes and may result in bite lacerations of the tongue. During the convulsion, maternal respirations stop and the patient turns blue because of the desaturated hemoglobin in her bloodstream. As the attack ends, she gradually resumes breathing and her color returns. Typically, she will remain comatose for varying lengths of time. If convulsions are frequent, she will remain comatose throughout. If infrequent, she may become arousable between attacks. If untreated, convulsions may become more frequent, followed by maternal death. In more favorable circumstances, recovery occurs. Eclampsia should be aggressively treated with magnesium sulfate, followed by prompt delivery, often requiring a cesarean section. It's important to remember that there can be other causes for seizures in pregnant women. Among them, strokes, hypoxia, hemorrhage, illicit drug use, brain tumors, infection, and a variety of metabolic disorders. During an eclamptic seizure, the fetal heart rate will typically respond with a bradycardia lasting 3 to 5 minutes, followed by a reactive tachycardia with decreased variability and occasional decelerations. While troubling to watch, these changes will generally resolve with the return of maternal oxygenation and placental perfusion. Occasionally, a placental abruption occurs in association with the eclamptic seizure, and in those cases, the fetal heart rate abnormalities fail to resolve, prompting consideration for immediate delivery. There's also the HELLP syndrome, H-E-L-L-P. The HELLP syndrome is characterized by hemolysis, elevated liver enzymes, and low platelets. So the H is for hemolysis, the E-L is for elevated liver enzymes, and the L-P is for low platelets. This serious condition is associated with severe preeclampsia, and the treatment is similar, delivery with prophylaxis against maternal seizures. In addition, these patients may need platelet transfusions, particularly with platelet counts well below 50,000. Despite this, oozing is frequently an ongoing problem until the HELLP syndrome gradually cools off. Unlike preeclampsia, patients with HELLP syndrome may continue to experience clinical problems for days to weeks or occasionally even months. If the HELLP syndrome is mild, it may gradually resolve spontaneously, but more severe forms often require intensive, prolonged care to achieve a favorable outcome.